What I thought it might be good to do would be to deal in this session with the path of devotion. Now, Swami, when we say he is God, he seems to be a very awesome person, one of whom we are afraid because of his great power and his great knowledge, that he knows us through and through. Swami is a great man for jokes. He loves jokes. He loves to laugh. And usually he has some person fairly close to him with whom he can crack jokes back and forth. And one example of his humor. A lady came to see Swami, an Indian lady, who lived quite a long ways away from Puttaparthi in the center of India. And she had an interview. And when Swami came to her, he said, don't hug me so tight. Well, everyone in the room, well, the lady wasn't hugging Swami, she was sitting on the floor. Everybody in the room was puzzled. But then afterwards, upon inquiry, it turned out that this lady had the habit, the custom, I should say, not habit, that's a bad word, had the custom of every evening sitting in front of Swami's chair. Because like all good Sai devotees, Swami is a permanent resident of the house. And they have in the house a chair reserved only for Swami, for Swami to sit in. So she moved in front of this chair, and she visualized Swami sitting in the chair. And then she puts her arms around his legs and hugs him. Mind you, this is about 2,500 miles away from Puttaparthi. And so that was the occasion of Swami asking her, please don't hug me quite so tight. So, life with Swami is not all serious. But it also has a purpose. That is, nowadays they tell me that people come from Europe dressed in shorts and jerseys, and they take Puttaparthi as sort of a vacation. And they tell me that after these groups have gone, they have even found some drug paraphernalia and even some bottles of liquor. So those people are totally missing their chance. You see, those who have first encountered Swami and those who are old-time devotees, we just simply don't realize our great fortune. If one stays ignorant, he can remain ignorant all his life. You probably know people who are ignorant, and they don't learn. They stay ignorant all of their lives. So it's possible to stay ignorant all of your life, and then the next life be ignorant, and the next life, and the next life, and the next life. Extending the sojourns in this world of name and form infinitely can be millions of years as we measure years. But what dispels ignorance is knowledge. You see something is wrong and you know better, and therefore the ignorance disappears. Now, the great overwhelming ignorance of all people is the ignorance that their real nature is divine. That's the real ignorance. Forgetting the self, identifying oneself with the things of the body and the things of the world, and forgetting the actual truth that one is divine, eternal, never changing, always demonstrating full bliss. So, how can that basic ignorance be uncovered? Mind you, the man ignorant about caring for his garage or doing work can go to a library or a teacher and learn what to do. But who can tell you the nature of yourself inside of you, inside of your mind, inside of your feelings, and how to wend your way through all the obstacles until you reach the goal of the self, the eternal self, which never changes and which always is? Now, who possesses such knowledge? And possessing it, who is able to tell us? Mind you, the great sages and saints of history, who through their own effort, with the help of a sacred guru, have dispelled ignorance about themselves and become liberated while still alive. Most of them are dead and gone. The others are hiding in caves in the Himalayas. And the others, if they're out of the Himalayas at all, they avoid a contact with people. Swami told me one time, when I was asking him about the divisions of evolution, the seven stages of evolution, after man coming Superman. So I asked Swami, if these people in the Himalayas were supermen, and if one could contact them for teachings. And Swami said, no, they are not supermen, not that stage. They are people trying to get liberation, and in some cases succeeding. Now, if you spent years, Hyslop, tracing them down, and followed one around, hoping that he would stop and talk to you and enlighten you, he wouldn't bother telling you a thing. So where are we going to learn this vital secret, this untold secret, this hidden secret of how to overcome the misery of life and know the heart and the seed of life, which is bliss? You know, someone asked a guru, I think it was Ramana Maharshi, is it true that all life is misery? And Ramana Maharshi replied, otherwise, how do you explain this universal search for pleasure? So, we all search for happiness, because happiness is our true nature, the nature of the self. And because of ignorance, we search for happiness and pleasure, and get involved in all sorts of karmic cause-effect consequences. So, who is going to be able to break that vicious cycle? For you and I may be incarnate for millions of times, living millions of lives in pure misery, never knowing the truth. Who knows the truth? Who is able to tell us that truth? It is the avatar who knows the truth, who has the power to tell us the truth. Only through the avatar can great numbers of people like us, people not privileged to sit at the foot of a guru in a Himalayas cave, only because of that identity in the world, the avatar, can great numbers of people like you and I ever have the chance of hearing the truth, of being able to ask questions, being guided, and able to achieve liberation in this very life, this very lifetime. Now just think, how many, if we accept Shir Desai, who had a reclusive life up in the Himalayas, the foothills of the Himalayas, then prior to Swami, the only other avatar capable of doing what I have described was Krishna. But Krishna lived some 5,000 years ago, and he lived in a rural India where a journey of 200 miles was like you and I traveling around the world, and only a limited number of people could come to Krishna. And then you look further back, thousands and thousands of years when there's been no opportunity to hear the truth, to practice the truth, and to achieve liberation from the round of birth and death in this very life. Only because Sri Satya Sai is born into this world at his own volition and has the power and the love to tell all those who care to listen the truth about themselves, the Maya about themselves, and how to dispel Maya and reach the goal of every person. That is to return to the source from which he came. That is the goal of every one of us. To return to the source, God, the divine, from which we came forth as manifestations in Maya. Now then, that being so, Just calculate your good fortune. Not only are you born in the same years as an avatar is here on earth, therefore with the opportunity of perhaps coming across a book or some person who knows him. After all, there are what, 5 billion people in the world at the present time? That's population at the present time. Of those 5 billion people in the world at the present time, how many are going to encounter Sai? Even though Sai is available and word about him is quite widespread, how many of the 5 million are going to be able to encounter Sai, have the possibility of hearing this teaching, and the further possibility of doing something about it? Obviously, I think the answer has to be very few. Very few, a few million out of the 5 billion. And then, out of that 5 million, how many have the opportunity of coming into a Sai center where every week people talk about Sai, where the books are all there, where you can talk with each other about your experiences, and where you know that Sai lives in India, and you can get on an airplane and go there and look at him and listen to him directly? How many of the 5 billion are so lucky, have such good karma, that they can enjoy that situation? Not too many. And you are amongst that few. Members of Sai Center, you go to India, you can ask questions of people who've been there many times, and you have the opportunity in this very life to reach the goal of life, to do that which has to be done, no matter who you are, where you are, when you were born. And I think it a great shame if any one person leaves this conference not thoroughly grounded in what it is necessary for him or her to do in order to take advantage of this fantastic opportunity, which has been sort of dumped in our lap. Why? Because of our past good karma. Swami says that only those whom I call come to me. He says, they call, I call them, they can come to see me because of their past actions. They have accumulated a certain amount of good karma, like a person starts a savings account, and they put money in that savings account. Now, when the occasion arises, they can draw money out of that savings account and spend it. But unless they replenish that account, then the money is soon gone, and they're back in the same position they were before. Likewise with us. Because Swami has called us to him, we have accumulated, because of past good actions, a small amount of good karma. And in hearing of him, seeing him, we're calling upon and using that karma. Now, if we don't do something about it and engage in spiritual sadhana, that karma will be exhausted, that good karma. Then you're back in the great mass of mankind again. You've all seen people who come to Prasanthi Nilayam once, stay 1 day or 2 days, and depart. They've used up their savings account in a day or two, and were not sufficiently impressed to try and replenish it. If our objective is not just to be entertained, but to learn how to practice spiritual life so that we will be able to penetrate that which is false, those false ideas which envelop us and pierce that cloud of ignorance and see the truth and be the truth, then if that is your aim, then you have these two paths, the path of devotion and the path of wisdom. Now, I said both are essential, and I'll tell you how we know that both are essential. You've all heard of Adi Shankara, Shankaracharya, the great sage of the, I think he lived around 800 AD, something like that, fully liberated by age 5 or 6, and over his short 35 years, he codified Advaita, the non-dual truth, before he died. He's revered throughout the world as a great, sublime sage. Now, Swami, when speaking of Shankara, said, that Adi Shankara taught Advaita, that is, the non-dual truth, only one, not two. He taught the Advaita, but at the level of practice, at the level of action, his practice was devotion. So here's Adi Shankara, totally liberated, knowing himself to be the divine being shining forth, and also knowing himself to be the underlying current of divinity which supports the entire universe. And yet, despite that knowledge, that wisdom, in daily life, in day-to-day actions, with his devotees and with other people, he practiced devotion. So therefore, both are essential. Swami recently said that we have passed through the stages of worship and of action and have now entered college and must learn and practice Advaita. Now, first comes devotion, because that is the basis, and devotion merges into Advaita. In the Satya Yuga, the first one, there the main spiritual practice was meditation. That was the way people of those age, of that age, were able to overcome Maya and reach the goal. In the next Yuga, the Treta Yuga, the way for people in those age, that age, was a ceremonial worship. And in this Yuga, the Kali Yuga, the best, the simplest, and the most efficient method of practicing spiritual life is Namasmarana, that is, recitation of the name of the Lord. Now, you see, in our regular daily life, we are walking around totally immersed in ignorance, totally immersed in Maya. Every little thing that comes along in the office, in our play life, social life, distracts our attention and in itself creates more and more of karma. So if we are to get rid of, to be free of, the ignorance which envelops us and which expresses itself in such things as anger, dishonesty, jealousy, fear, distress, and which expresses itself in all those ways, then we must have God with us all day long, not just occasionally, but God must be with us every moment of the day, so that with him at hand, we can hold to the spiritual practice of keeping God in mind always. And keeping God in mind always, the best way to do that is to repeat God's name. Now, probably most of you have read The Way of a Pilgrim, which told about the Russian monks in the Middle Ages who roamed the country and the forest back and forth from monastery to monastery. And their spiritual practice was repeating God's name with the objective of having the name repeated automatically in the heart. Now, at that time, God was the Lord Jesus. So their prayer was, Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me, a sinner. They would repeat that all the time with every step, sometimes in rhythm with the step, sometimes in rhythm with the pulse, sometimes in rhythm with the heartbeat, but nevertheless, always repeating it. Now, that is what we need to do in this day and age. If the mind holds to the name of God all the time, then trouble will not develop. So, what name of God shall you use? It can be any name of God that is dear to your heart. It could be Lord Jesus, it could be Muhammad, it could be Krishna, or Rama, or whatever is dear to your heart. Because God is all names. Swami is all names. If you have any particular name, you might want to choose Sai Ram. Om 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 Sai Ram. And repeat that name all day long. For myself, it took me 3 years of hard work before I could do that. Hard, constant work. Now it comes natural, all the time, no matter where I am or what I am doing. Om Saram, Om Saram, Om Saram, Om Saram repeats in me. And I can tell you that if I wanted to do something bad, I couldn't do it. It's not possible. I couldn't do it. And I can tell you also that the repetition of God's name brings about vast beneficial changes in your life. Whether or not it would take me to liberation, we'll have to wait and see when I die. But anyway, it has done everything that Swami has said it would do in this life. Now, you might bring up an objection and say, well, I have a job. If when I'm in my job, I just keep repeating God's name, I'll get fired because I won't get any work done. But Swami says, now what you do is whenever your mind is not engaged in some vital, meaningful work task, then instead of letting the mind wander off into self-pity, anger at others, or all the things that this servant of the king can do to destroy him, destroy you, don't let the mind do that. Immediately it hasn't got some meaningful work to do, then bring it right back to repeating the name of God. So you don't neglect any task. Swami said that when you come to the task, then you say to him, Lord, now I must do this work. And Swami said, then concentrate on what you're doing. Give it full concentration. Because God himself is at the point of concentration. So therefore, doing your work with concentration is tantamount to continuing to repeat the name of God. Now, you know, I've been telling my dear colleagues and I this for how many years, I don't know. If I were to ask now, how many repeat God's name all day long, how many hands will I see? Not too many. I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why that's so. All the sages say that on the reason people remain in ignorance is because they do not continually and repeatedly recapitulate the truth. We do not continually remind ourselves of the truth, and therefore we forget and let things slide and do something else. Now that's one of the principal reasons that Swami formed the Satya Sai Baba organization with Satya Sai Baba centers. Because he said that my people of a like mind can come each week to the center and talk to each other about their experiences and about the spiritual path and encourage each other and give each other the strength to go back into the world for the week and not forget their spiritual sadhana and then come back to the center again and get the battery charged once again. And that is also why he wants to see some devotional songs in the language of the country. For example, now we're getting quite a few centers in Latin America. Dr. Goldstein, I'm in charge of everything in the United States. Goldstein has the job of organizing Latin America, all of Latin America, big job. And so he is forming Satya Sai Baba centers, just the way we have formed them here, for exactly the same purpose. Now, people in Mexico and in other Latin American countries are busy developing devotional songs in Spanish. Because many of the people who come to their centers don't understand the devotional songs in Telugu or in Sanskrit. They're just a mumble jumble of words. Extremely boring to one who sits there and hasn't the foggiest idea of what is being said. So likewise, here in the United States, he wants us to sing English songs. Now, if you've been a devotee for some time, you know about 3 years ago, I had one heck of a time when I tried to introduce English devotional songs to the centers. I got, you wouldn't believe it. It's just lucky that I don't take insult. Otherwise, I'd be awful mad at a lot of people. So, somebody then, one of our group, went to India, and he said to Swami, all this trouble Hislop's having with the English songs, what's going to be the outcome of it? Swami said, there'll be a lot of anger, a lot of malice showed, a lot of resistance, but in not too long, it'll all fall away, and they'll sing the English songs, and everything will be fine. So, everybody coming to our center, and everybody who was born in the time of the Avatar, who has a bit of savings in their account, is liable to be called by Swami to the center or to India. That person comes. If they have to sit through 45 minutes of Telugu bhajans, not understanding a single word of what is said, they'll go away and seldom come back. We ran a survey. All the centers in the United States found that thousands of people had come and very few had stayed. Then we set out in the various larger centers to interview those people who had come once and who had not come again. Why didn't you come back? Now, you don't know whether they're telling the truth or not, but just to accept what they say there are two principal reasons. One is those funny songs in the foreign language that I couldn't understand a word of and got so bored sitting there. And second, the absence of friendliness. People weren't really friendly to me. I was like an outsider, so I didn't come back. Since each of us has the tremendous benefit, has had the tremendous benefit, still has the tremendous benefit, knowing Swami, hearing about his teachings, of knowing that we can get free of this circle of birth and death and misery, why don't we give the others a chance? Don't have to sing all the songs in English. What's wrong with half in English? So at least the new people are not bored all the time, but only half the time. So they have a chance. Okay, now we've talked about path of devotion and how you, in this room, this very moment, can adopt that path. And Swami says again and again that in this Kali Yuga, that one path, if practiced conscientiously, continuously, is itself enough to completely break the cycle of birth and death. Just by repeating the name of God with love in your heart and in your mind, whenever your mind is not busy at work, you can free yourselves from this cycle of birth and death in this very life. Swami has said that not once, but over and over again. And the great sage Vasishtha, who lived at the time of Lord Rama, which would be, I believe, the Treta Yuga, some people approached him. And since he knew what was in their minds before they even approached him, just as does Swami, he said, yes, you want to ask. In the Kali Yuga, which will be the best method for liberation? The one most likely to be successful? And Vasishtha said, oh, the fortunate Kali Yuga. How fortunate is Kali Yuga? For in Kali Yuga, the only thing necessary is to repeat God's name with love. That is, in this Kali Yuga, we have come down to such a low status ourselves. Our intelligence, our willpower, our energy, it's not what it was some thousands of years ago. And we're not capable of doing those severe tapas, those strenuous exercises that the ancient sages used. And yet, evolution must continue. And so, Lord, has lowered the admission ticket, the price of admission, to just repeating his name with love. So I can't recommend to you too strongly that please do that. And you will not attend this meeting in vain. Now, in terms of devotion, there is another prime practice, which you should engage in at the same time that you engage in repetition of the sacred name. And that is called equal vision. Equal vision means seeing everyone the same. That is, every person, the only real thing in that person is God in the heart. Everything else is so much rubbish. Here for a few days, a few years, and gone. The only real thing in the person is God in the heart. So whenever you look at another person, look right through the troublesome personality to the reality in the heart, God. And perhaps say something like, "Dearest Lord, I love you." Or acknowledge God in the heart of that person. That will help him and will help you because you are keeping your mind on God at that moment. Now, people always bring up objections that people are so obnoxious, these horrible criminals, plus the boring people. How can I approach that obnoxious personality and say, "I love you"? Can't be done. But Swami says, no, that isn't what he means. That you look through the person. Now, the name and form you treat according to their status and their actions. Now, a criminal, you keep your distance. Don't we keep our distance from Brother Lion and Brother Tiger and Brother Cobra, even though they are God? Of course we do. In the same way, criminals, those who are liable to harm us, keep physical distance. Treat them as they are. Don't rush up to them, hug them, and offer them your purse and your home because you feel love. No. Treat the person according to their station and their actions. A servant in the house, you treat as a servant. Your sister, you treat as a sister. The boss, you treat as the boss. But look right through that and see God in the heart. And every time you do that, I will tell you that there will be a flash of happiness cross through your heart. You try it and you will see. Every time you recognize God as the reality of another person that you see, a flash of happiness will arise in your heart. Now, there are other supplementary techniques also, but these are the two vital ones. And if you will follow those, you will certainly reach your goal. You will know your real self. You'll be free of birth and death. You'll be happy always. Doing good always, as long as you're in the body. It's not hard. Try it. Do it. All you have to do, your mind wanders away to something else. But don't be angry at the mind or swear at it or something of the sort. Just notice that the mind has wandered and bring it right back. It's wandered, bring it back. Bring it back. Swami says if you do that, before long it will stay. It won't wander, just like a cow in a pasture. If left free, it will wander into the neighbor's fields all the time. But if tethered to a post, it will stay in its own field. So the same with the mind. Bring it back. Bring it back to the self. Bring it back to the name always. And before long, it will stay there. Then it will be, like I told you, automatic. All the time repeating in your mind. No matter where you are, what you're doing, the name repeats. When work stops, the mind is filled with the name, the divine name. Now, on the basis of the path of devotion, okay, let's have some questions. Any question at all. The questions are more important than what I say in the talk, because the questions arise from the difficulties that you are encountering. And if I can give a clue, perhaps what Swami says, to how that particular problem can be solved, it helps not only you, but everybody else. Years ago, before I wrote Conversations with Satya Sai Baba, we would be sitting on the porch, the veranda of the old house, and I would ask a question and Swami would give an answer. And the people sitting there would say, "Oh, that's a good question. It's a valuable." Then Swami would say, "Yes, good for everybody." Now, I was too dumb to realize that what he was telling me was, keep careful record of these conversations and publish them. I didn't understand what he was saying when he said this, must have said 50 times. Finally, I was forced to publish the questions and answers. But, so according to Swami, you see, the questions and the answers are extremely important. Now, when you ask a question, you not only help yourself, you help everybody else. Because probably that same question is in the minds of a dozen or so people in this room, no matter what the question may be. So any question at all, doesn't matter, relevant or not. The question is, when is Swami coming here in the flesh? You know, it's got to the point now where when I ask Swami when he's coming, he says, "What? Don't they know I've already been there?" So beyond that, I don't know. As far as the flesh is concerned, when I hear the airplane is in mid-ocean with Swami aboard, then maybe I'll believe it. Next question. Yes, the center has three functions, really. It has the function of seva, of service, to the community. Now, why should you bother doing service? Heavens knows there are enough government agencies trying to spend money and all sorts of church groups and other kinds of groups doing service. Why should you others also bother doing service? Very important reason. See, Swami said, the basis of all this ignorance which envelops us is the ego, the I idea. The idea that I exist as a separate individual, the ego. And in order to break this ignorance and understand the truth, the ego must subside. And Swami says that one of the very finest ways to reduce the ego is to serve other people. Now, you're serving usually people less fortunate than yourself. And here you have to come down off your mighty throne and serve these inferior people. Okay? So it's a blow to the ego. Moreover, it shows the community that the face of Sai's teaching is loving and caring for the fellow human beings. So that's one purpose of the Sai community, the Sai Center. The next one is Valdikas, teaching children. We all know that they say, unless you catch the child by 5 years old, he's lost, he's gone. True or not, I don't know, but that is the saying. It's true that you have to catch children young. And therefore, the Valdikas program is to catch young children and to start to educate them on what are true human values as contrasted to street values. They'll learn the values of the street fast enough, but where are they going to learn the spiritual values and the true human values in this society today? You tell me. There are a long few, many, many schools in between. Maybe this school here does that. Looks like a good place here. So that's why the Valdikas program. And that's true. Now, the third is the practice of spirituality. That is, that's what we have been talking about, how to overcome this vast maya or ignorance that envelops us, and how to gain freedom and liberation. That's the third aspect of the center. The next, there is a fourth aspect also, which covers all three, and that is, the center exists to show the face of Swami's teachings to the community. That's why the standards of conduct have to be so high in the center. Because in order to know the guru, people look at the disciple as a measure of the guru. And therefore, people look at our behavior as center members in the community. And that's the way they judge Swami. If we do things that are not right, then they're entitled to say, Swami teaches these people to do that. No, I don't want any part of it. So that's a big responsibility. And that's why we're so strict on behavior, why occasionally we have to remove officers who don't understand that. Now, an important part of the center, which may have fallen into disuse because I haven't been hitting at too recently, is that what's the use of being a Sai devotee as far as the community is concerned? You're in the community, you're living in the community, and therefore you have a relationship with the community, and somebody in the community says, what does this man Sai Baba teach? What is he saying? Now, isn't it reasonable that you, who are a devotee of Sai, and who attend the center, the study circles, and study Sai's teachings, isn't it reasonable to expect that you would be able to give some meaningful answer to that inquiry? What is wrong in expecting you to be able to do that? Yet, unless we engage in the practice of putting all these subliminal impressions we've gathered into extrovert form in the way of words and explanations, when we're challenged, we simply won't be able to think of anything to say. And that's what happens again and again and again. So therefore, we have the program in the center that every meeting, one member should stand up and in about 5 minutes, not more than 5 minutes, just a little bit of time, say one teaching of Swami. Just one teaching of Swami. If the man or the lady hasn't developed the self-confidence needed to stand in front of people and say something, then they can read the passage until they get the confidence where they can say it without reading. Then, as that goes round and round the center, then everybody is equipped to answer the question, what does this man Sai Baba teach? What's it all about? You'll be able to give some sensible answer. Then, to further that, and to make it more interesting, we have the program where the centers in a particular location trade speakers back and forth. That is, as a speaker develops in Sacramento, then there's a night when that speaker visits Fresno and gives the speech in Fresno. And Fresno, in turn, visits another center and gives the speech there. So that encourages us to be able to answer what Swami does. What else about the center would you like to know? Did that answer your question?
It did. Where do you feel the failings are in the centers in the U.S.?
I think it's a general failing of not taking the thing seriously enough. You know, it tends to be a social event and a pastime, a place where we go and listen to the beautiful bhajans, and that creates a nice, pleasant feeling in us. And I have spoken here of the very serious side of our opportunity. And as evidenced by the fact that very few people practice the basic thing in devotional, spiritual devotion, the repetition of the name, we have to assume that people in general are not taking it seriously. I think that's the principal reason. Now, how can that change? It can only change by the center having some way of continually recapitulating these points and stressing the importance of them again and again and again, because that is what the sages say. And you can see it's true. Now, how many lives have we experienced? We don't know. It could be a million. It could be something simply crazy. And in all those past lives, we spent practicing actions which have resulted in the kind of a person we are now. Careless, unattending, not uninterested, and so on. See? Now, we want to change that, but we can't do it by snapping our fingers. Just as it took time and practice to make us what we are now, it will likewise take time and sincere practice to change the way we regard things now, and lead us to take this extraordinary opportunity seriously and really make a vow to ourselves that we will not waste one more minute of the few remaining years of our lives. We die without liberation. What a mountain of karma there is piled up behind us from all these lives. And in many of these lives, we engaged in bad actions. You can believe that. Whom we die now, we come back into another body. Who knows where the winds of karma will carry us in the next birth? Maybe to some isolated spot where we have no chance of hearing or learning anything. Don't waste today. This is the time. This life is the time. And that has to be continually repeated in the center. That point made again and again and again. The subject of round table discussions, the subject of discussions between individuals, and so on. Vital importance. Does Sai Baba recommend any particular kind of sit-down meditation or yoga practice? You see, Swami says of meditation as we do it now from our present status, our present level, that the benefit of meditation is that it gives the mind a rest. It doesn't take us to liberation at this particular point, but does give the mind a rest. And for that reason, it is beneficial. In terms of yoga, yoga means union. So his entire teaching is yoga, union with God. His teaching is that at every moment of our life, we should be in union with God. Think always of God. Dwell always in God. Be part of Him. Do those actions which the Lord would do. Generous. Wise. So that is yoga. That is union. That is Swami's message. Yes. He says he finds such a joy in service, but some people just won't do it. Well, that's always the case with any endeavor. Not everybody sees the same. I have said what seems to me the truth after all these years with Swami, repeating what Swami has said. But there may be people in the audience who see things quite differently, not agreeing at all with what I've said. You see, really, it doesn't matter who you follow, what path you follow, or what guru you follow. Because Swami has said again and again that the very crux, the very center of spiritual practice is purification of the mind and the heart. That every spiritual sadhana, whether it be yoga or any other spiritual, pranayama, whatnot, any spiritual practice you can think of, it has the one object of purifying the mind and the heart. Because once mind and heart are purified, then full truth flashes across that mind and heart like a bolt of lightning, completely liberating us. That is, it doesn't matter who you follow. Unless you purify mind and heart, in fact, they say, if Shiva came down himself and the other members of the Trinity came down to earth and sat in front of you and tutored you, it wouldn't do you one iota of good unless you had mind and heart purified. Now, Swami will purify the mind and the heart for you. See, that's the whole underlying purpose of keeping Him in mind always and repeating His name always. Now just imagine, right now you might be full of anger and jealousy and all sorts of things. If Swami were living in your house, and every time you went out of the house, you would take Swami's hand and walk hand in hand with Swami down the street, would you be having time to entertain all these emotions and thoughts of jealousy, anger, hatred, and whatnot? In the presence of the Lord, how could you? It's impossible. You see, all these bad traits, which comprise ignorance. They are flowers of the night. They grow in ignorance. They cannot grow in knowledge. So therefore, when we take Swami with us in devotion to Him, then wherever we go, we're in God's light. And in God's light, these evil plants cannot survive. They will go away naturally. You go to a psychiatrist and say, hey, I'm having lots of trouble because of jealousy. He removes jealousy and immediately the balance of the system comes into something even worse. But with Swami, the things just wither away and die down until they disappear naturally. And your mind and heart are pure without your doing any volitional thing to do it. So, Swami can purify mind and heart. And in that way, He can give you liberation. But unless mind and heart are purified, there's nothing He can do. So this keeping Him in mind always, every moment that you're not working, is of the most vital importance. Next question. You see, in terms of celibacy, the young person must be celibate. He must, otherwise, his character will waver and he'll be in deep trouble later on. But when he marries, he shouldn't be celibate. There's no need to. The family life can be lived up until age 60. At age 60, because then the person should give all of their attention to liberation. Completely abandon the worldly pleasures, the worldly joys, because as long as we hold to the worldly pleasures and the worldly joys, we will not find the time or the interest to look in to try and find that real joy. So therefore, all pleasures have to be abandoned because you see they're no good. They don't last. They deceive you. You look for the pleasure and go and act and look at the trouble you get into through that action. And moreover, the pleasure doesn't last. Changes, maybe the object which would give you the greatest joy, in a little while causes you the greatest of pain. So therefore, that's what Swami says about family life. Okay, next lady. The question is, if we just repeat the name, that's only half. We're supposed to repeat the name with love for God in our heart. So the question really is, how does one develop love for God? You see, intrinsically, everybody loves himself. Even the worst person loves himself. He may love himself so much that he can't even bear his present body and commit suicide. But every person loves themselves. And because oneself is God, and love is God, so when we contact God, love is there as part and parcel of that. All right. But nevertheless, in our worldly daily life, we may be so caught up in daily life that we don't feel that love for God. Yes, we don't feel that love for God. So then how to develop that love for God, which has to be there? It is there, but it's not manifest. Swami says that the best way to develop love for God is to own God. He said, that which you don't own, as contrasted to that which you own, display quite a difference in your affection. The mother may like all the kids on the street, but she doesn't feel exactly the same about the other kids as she does hers, because they're hers. And he said to me, that time I was carrying a tape recorder, which he finally made me throw away. He said, the tape recorder's up here. He said, Hislop, this tape recorder that you love so much, you're always carrying it. I never see you without it. He said, now when you passed that in the window, Hislop, sitting in the window for sale, you didn't have any feeling for it at all. But once you went in and bought the tape recorder and took it out of the shop and started to carry it with you as yours, you love it all the time. I see you do. See? So he said, the way to love God, to bring out that love, which is there, is to feel you own God. Like that lady I told you the story, that she visualized Swami sitting in her chair, and she loves him so much that she clasps his legs and expresses her love. She feels Swami belongs to her. He's right there in her house. So practice feeling that Swami belongs to you. He's yours, and he is yours. He's in your heart, in your house. Why don't you have a chair for Swami? Why don't you have Swami as a permanent resident, a member of your family in your house? I suggest to you that when you go home, you locate one of the nice chairs and put it aside for Swami, maybe with a picture of him on the seat of the chair. And no members of the family use it, because every time you gather, there's Swami. He belongs to you, belongs to your family. In that way, you start to feel love for Swami, I assure you. That was a process that occurred with me. It's a process that occurs with many people. It's a process that Swami himself recommends. What has Swami said to me about the value of vegetarian diet? He says that this body is just a mound of food. It's made of food. If you stop adding food to the mound of food, the body passes away, dies. In order to keep it alive, you have to continually feed it food. Now, the mound of food, the body is made up of the food that you add to it. And when you eat the flesh of animals, then animals are subject to strong emotions. Anger, rage, fear, so on. And all the animal tendencies. So you eat that, that's added to the body, and creates some small handicap to clear it out of the system. But he also said that when a person is sick, then he needs strong vitamins, like mutton and chicken. That's right. So the point is that if you're a vegetarian, that's not going to guarantee you liberation. And the point is that if you're a meat eater, that does not put a bar in front of you in terms of liberation. Both, every person in this world, man, woman, and child, is equally entitled to realize their own nature. Not to get something from somebody, but to realize their own nature. Who can stop you from the inward travel from yourself to yourself? Nobody. And that's what the liberation is. The journey from yourself to yourself. Any other questions? Seizing on desires. You see, somehow or other, you have to start looking at your desires. That is, one is ignorant because of lack of knowledge. If one gains knowledge, then ignorance is dispersed. Now, in order to gain knowledge of oneself, you have to start to look at yourself. Start to, even if you don't do anything about it right at the moment, you have to look inside and see what are your desires, what are your tendencies. And if you look long and steadily at yourself, then that ignorance, which is maya or false in the first place, will go away and you will see the truth. Now, the illustration they give in your country, where they're always worried about snakes and where in the dim light of the evening, they see a piece of rope in the path. Hey, that's a cobra. And then they engage in actions based on that perception that there's a cobra there. Maybe back up and run, maybe engage in some accident or something. Now, when you investigate what you see, the cobra, you find that the cobra is just a rope. That is, the illusion is gone. The illusion of the snake disappears because it is only an illusion in the first place, and the real undercurrent, or the rope rather, is there. Now, precisely the same thing in regards to yourself. See, first of all, did anybody in the world who investigated the snake rope phenomena fail to dispel that maya and see a rope there? Obviously, nobody. So the same way with yourself. In order to see what is real underneath this false appearance, like the rope and the snake, You have to look at yourself. Study yourself. You have to see your desires. When you see your desires, you look at them. Do they really give me pleasure? How about the objects that they lead me to? What kind of objects are they? Do they last? Do they change? Do they explode in my face and so on? So when you see the truth about these desires, which are really bringing you misery, underneath and beyond the temporary pleasure, then you will have a ceiling on desires. You won't engage in them anymore. Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Hislop.